All right, it's good to see everybody here tonight. We are continuing our study. We're going to be transitioning into kind of a different section of the book of Ecclesiastes tonight. We'll be finishing up kind of what we were talking about vanity in the world, and continuing our discussion a little bit about money. We kind of hurriedly went through the end of chapter 5 this past Wednesday, so we'll be looking kind of at that just briefly as we transition into chapter 6. But here's our heading with chapter 6. So as we look at this section of Scripture, it starts off chapter 6, verse 1. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is prevalent among men. We see this as kind of a repeat phrase. We saw this earlier in chapter 5, right? What do we see in chapter 5, verse 13? There is a grievous evil which I've seen under the sun. And so he repeats this phrase again. But nestled in between chapter 6, verses 1 through 9, we have chapter 5, 18 through 20, is kind of counter, is sort of the opposite of what we're going to be looking at here in chapter 6. He says, beginning in verse 18 of chapter 5, "Here's what I've seen to be good and fitting, to eat and drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor, and enjoy which toils, he toils under the sun during the few years of life which God has given to him, for this is a reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has empowered him." And this is what we kind of see the opposite of. "God has empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is a gift of God." So he clearly will not consider, verse 20, the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. So we see this kind of great picture of where balance is in place, where I have riches, I have wealth, I'm taken care of, but I have them balanced in perspective to God. That's harmony. He's not saying it's wrong to have wealth, is he? In this, he's painting a good picture where everything's in balance, where my wealth and my obedience to God and godliness, those things are all in harmony. And that's a good thing, and painted a picture there. But now we're going to see in chapter 6, we're going to switch to kind of a different perspective. And this is where he begins saying, "There's an evil which I've seen under the sun and is prevalent among men." He begins talking about wealth and happiness and a rich person without enjoyment. Have you ever seen that? Somebody who has lots of money but is not very happy. You know, some of you may have watched the Donald Duck version of the Christmas carols or whatever. You know, Ebenezer Scrooge typically is not as foreseen as a happy individual, but he has lots of money, right? He says, "There's an evil which I've seen, is a man whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God has not empowered him to eat from them." How is this different? What do we see differently from verse 9, chapter 5, verse 9, and then we see here in chapter 6, verse 2? How is this different? He's enjoying it, but what? Yes, and that's kind of the key. That's God's given the person wealth, but then giving them the ability to enjoy it. Where it seems that in this particular individual, they have wealth, but they're not able to enjoy it. He says, "For a foreigner enjoys them, this is vanity and a severe affliction." There's a lot of things we can say about this, but kind of backing up. Here, he says, "A man whom God has given riches, wealth, and honor." Does Solomon know anybody that might have fit that bill? Himself, right? If you want to write out there, 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 13, you can specifically see where God blessed him with those things. "Because you did not ask for wealth, and because you did not ask for the head of your enemy, but you asked for wisdom, then I'll give you these other things." So Solomon is in a unique position to be writing about this kind of thing, right? But what are some ways where a foreigner could take what we have? Here's a situation where he's saying, here's the wealth I have. I worked, I've amassed wealth, but now a foreigner has it. How does that happen? Any ideas? So yeah, maybe when you die, You're not taking that with you, right? What are some other ways that happened more in ancient times than today? Well, yeah, more in ancient times. War. What happened in war? Yeah, they take your stuff, right? When they exile you, you don't get to keep all your shiny things, right? They take it from you. And so that it could be alluded to here as well. So that's something that he could be talking about is, you know, here's a situation where I've amassed this wealth and somebody else is living in my house. Look in Psalm chapter 17, and you'll see this kind of as we transition into this next verse. Psalm chapter 17, verses 14 and 15. He says, "From men with your hand, O Lord, from men of the world whose portion is in his life." So what he holds as important is in his life. "And whose belly you fill with treasure, they are satisfied with children and leave their abundance to their babes. As for me, I shall behold your face in righteousness. I will be satisfied with your likeness when I awake." What is David, or what is the psalmist talking about here? So verse 14, you have people who are satisfied with just living this life, having what you have, having your bellies full, and living something to their children. Verse 15, he says, "As for me," as though in contrast, "I'm looking forward to what?" Yeah, being saved. When he says, to be satisfied with your likeness when I awake. When I awake from what? From death. That's what I'm looking forward to, right? That's what I'm looking forward to. And so, again, with Ecclesiastes, we're contrasting a lot in, oh, I say we. The writer, Solomon, is contrasting a lot of human wisdom and its logical end and godly wisdom and how that is contrasted. As we kind of move on in this section of Scripture, we see this person who has wealth but he's not able to enjoy it. We have somebody who is a sad, rich individual. And then you have a rich person without riches. And this is the second part of chapter 2. That somebody else enjoys them. Somebody else is enjoying those things. And then in verse 3, we kind of go to what the psalmist kind of writes about. Verses 3 through 5. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years. Now obviously these are exaggerated numbers, right? We're not talking about somebody who actually has 100 children. Although with Solomon it may have been possible. But here is a situation where we're talking about extreme numbers. He says, even if he fathers 100 children and lives many years, however they be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, and he does not even have a proper burial, then I say, better is a miscarriage than he. What is he saying here about a life well lived? He says, even if you've had all these things, but you don't live a good, if you don't have good things, you're not satisfied with good things. What is he saying here in relationship to the miscarriage? It might have been better not to even been born than to have all these children and have this long life, but not been able to enjoy that life. It's interesting that he compares this again. Been born at all. We saw that earlier, right, in chapter 2, talking about those who were severely oppressed, and that severe oppression, it would have been better not to have been born. And so he's quick to go there with this thing. And look over, somebody please, to Jeremiah chapter 22. Jeremiah chapter 22, verse 19. Would somebody read that for us? Jeremiah 22:19. All right, so here's some people who, you know, prophets, when they come in, their message wasn't always really pretty, right? their message wasn't always just like, hey guys, you know what? You should probably not do that anymore. They usually came in with some very harsh messages. And in this case, Jeremiah is no exception. Therefore, beginning verse 18, therefore thus says the Lord in regard to Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah. So we're not talking about just any old dude, right? We're talking about the son of Josiah. He said, what is his death going to be like? You're going to die like a donkey, right? You're going to have the death of a donkey. What should the death of a king be? Should have much more pomp and circumstance than dragging it and throwing it out on the other side of the door, right? Throwing it out in the Gehenna, down in the trash heap, is basically what we're saying. So that is not a proper burial. That is not something anybody enjoys. There's a lot of emphasis placed on burial. Even today, that's still a lot of emphasis placed on burial, especially when you start seeing the zeros that it costs out beside the price of burials. But in this case, if somebody had this kind of life and didn't even have a proper burial, it'd be better for them not to have been born. And what's interesting is what he says here about in verse 4 and 5, for it comes in futility. This is New American Standard. For it comes in futility and goes into obscurity. Its name is covered in obscurity. Who are we talking about, verse 4? The child that would have been born, right? So the child that would have been born is not even remembered. And here's some, and according to Solomon, here's three blessings that the other person did not have, verse 5. It never sees the sun. It never works, it never toils in the sun. It never knows anything. It doesn't know good or bad, right? We know life is very tumultuous, right? We don't know kind of what's going to happen. And it doesn't have to experience any of the bad. It doesn't really experience anything. And in this case, that blessing. And it says it is better off than he, or that some translations talks about the rest. It has rest that the other person does not have, that the wealthy individual that had all this time and had all his children did not have that rest. And so he contrasts them and talks about it's better for that person to have never been born than to have that kind of life. And here's how we know he's talking about exaggerated numbers, verse 6. We're talking, can anybody live 1,000 years? Would anybody want to live 1,000 years? That's maybe the second question. If the other man lives 1,000 years twice and does not enjoy good things, do not all go to one place. We've talked about this. What one place is he talking about? Death. Everybody dies, right? Everybody dies. Now, some people may die like a donkey, apparently, but everybody dies. Everybody's going to die. And so even if you've lived this long, you still will die. And so if you've not been able to enjoy the life that you've lived, then it's better off not having lived it. And remember, keeping everything in context, he's not talking about a hedonistic lifestyle, right? That's not what Solomon's trying to get at, because he said, I've tried that. Just so you know, chapters 1 and 2, I got that out of the way, right? We're not talking about a hedonistic lifestyle. We're talking about a life lived with everything in balance with God. So that's what he said. If you don't get to enjoy and have a good life, which we saw in other chapters about what defines a good life, then it may not have been good to live at all. Looking at wealth and desire, verses 7 through 9. All man's labor is for his mouth. Which is saying what? All our labor is for our mouths. Which is not a very pretty way of saying we labor to consume, right? We labor to consume. I think more than any other generation, we are very much consumers. Right? Would you agree with that? Amazon saying amen, right? So we are consumers. We consume. And that's what he's saying here. Is anything new under the sun? No, it hasn't changed. We've always been consumers. All man's labor is for his mouth. And every once in a while, he's full and never wants anything else. Is that what the text says? No, our appetite is never full. How many of you, you don't have to raise your hands. You can just think. How many of you have thought, you know, let's just say cell phones because everybody has them, right? My cell phone is old. It's not even a smartphone anymore, right? It's like, well, it's not a smartphone anymore. Let's just say that. If I had a better phone, my life would be so much easier, right? So many things that would be better. And you do the research, and you watch all the reviews, and which one's going to be best for you, and, you know, the buttons and the apps, and you get so focused in that. And then you finally, the day comes, and you get the phone. Did it change your life as much as you wanted? A year later, you're thinking, you know what? My phone is not as smart as you. So are we ever satisfied, right? Have we ever gotten to the point where, you know, if I just had this thing, and we get so focused on that. Yes, sir. Yes, spend all this time and money purchasing this thing, and then what? By the time you get it, it's out of date already. So annoying. Technology. Ugh. Okay. But where would we be without technology? So anyway, but you get the point. Are we ever satisfied with whatever that thing that we're obsessing over? And typically, no, we're not. And the appetite is never satisfied. And this is, again, kind of, in this case, there's nobody that has an edge on this. Nobody has an edge over what's going on. He says, "For what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? And what advantage does the poor man have knowing how to walk, or a prudent poor man?" No, all of them, all people struggle with this. This is a common thing that we all struggle with. Now, if I know that this is a struggle, and I know that I've already experienced in the past where I've obsessed over an object or a thing or a situation, and when it came to pass, it really left me disillusioned about what my hopes and dreams were going to happen with this item, thing, whatever. If I know that, will I still repeat it? Yes, we're still going to do it again. We're going to do it again. We're going to do it again. It happens. But Solomon's saying that's not something that a wise or poor, like, you're not better than anybody else because you have or have not. Everybody experiences that thing. Because life and stuff is temporary, right? Everything fades away. I think I've told you before, I worked like a motorcycle jet ski store, and people would obsess. Like, we had guys that would come in and look and pet, you know, the motorcycles before they'd buy them. I'm not kidding. It was my job to wipe their drool and fingerprints off of them when they got done petting it. So then they'd finally come and buy it, right? And then what happens? It breaks. They wreck it. I no joke, I delivered a motorcycle to this. This mom bought a motorcycle for this 18-year-old kid that just got a job. It was like for those of you who know, it was a YZ600, like a sport bike, right? Literally when they were seeing if the financing would go through, she said, if the financing goes through, then it's from God. And I held my tongue. I didn't say anything, right? But I had to deliver this bike to this guy's house, all right? So we put it up on the flatbed, delivered it, and he's talking about, oh, man, it's going to be so great. My friends are going to be jealous. And I'm like, dude, this is like a pretty powerful bike. You need to, like, slow down. He didn't even have insurance for it yet. He didn't have his motorcycle driver's license for it yet. He just got this bike, dropped it off. I went a different way home than I had come. If I had gone the same way home, I would have got to see him wreck it, break his arm, those 10 minutes after getting it home. Stuff, right? Stuff. We obsess, and we get involved in that kind of stuff. And Psalmist, or the writer of Ecclesiastes, is telling us here that everybody, wise or fool, is going to fall into this. Everybody does it. What the eye see is better than what the soul desires. We would say a bird in hand, right? What the soul, it literally says what the soul goes after. This too is futility and striving after the wind. So Solomon really pegs people here. It's just our desires for things. Have we ever changed? Have we evolved beyond this need? We have not. We are still falling into this. Yes, sir. Yep. So that desire to have, that going after the thing, all the research, and that is sometimes more fun than, oh yeah, there's always a new widget, right? There's always something out there to get our credit card numbers going. Okay, so let's look at this last section here. We start in kind of chapter 6, verse 10, we start kind of a new transition, a new section in the book, and looking at counsel for troubled times. Anybody? Counsels for troubled times. We should really be praying for the brethren in Venezuela. It's crazy down there right now, if you all have been watching any of that, but we should really be praying for our brethren in Venezuela. It's counsel for troubled times. So here we begin this kind of talking about man's ignorance, mankind's ignorance. Whatever exists has already been named, and it is known what man is, for he cannot dispute with him who is stronger. Who is stronger than man? God. All right. There's a lot of things that are stronger than man. Even nature is stronger than man. How many times has man been arrogant to say, well, we'll do this, we'll build this, and it'll never be destroyed, blah, blah, blah. Hashtag Titanic, right? So there's a lot of things that maybe we have been arrogant about and saying that, you know, and God obviously is prominent, figures prominently in that, but even nature, we can't speak against nature. And so what he's saying is things have been set, and mankind, our limits have been known, and we can't dispute that. Isaiah chapter 45, verse 9, I think we've mentioned this before, talking about what the potter can say to the clay. The clay say to the potter? Nothing, right? The clay can't say, well, you did that wrong. You made me this way, right? You can't say that to God. But I want to look at Job chapter 40. Job chapter 40. I like, the book of Job is great. But if you're reading through Job, I get really excited when I get towards the end. And God asked Job to stand up. Right? I would not want to be in that position. But here's where it happens. Here's what's going on. You know, the Lord said to Job, "Will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it." Would you want to be in that position? Would you want to be there? No, and that's that same kind of thing. Like, what can we say to God? God, you did it all wrong, right? God can rebuttal and say, I made it perfect, you messed it up, right? You touched it last, okay? So you messed it up. And so we make sure that even in our thoughts and our contemplations about God, that we're not in that arena. We're not going down that path with things. You know, what is the, in many words, he says here, in many words, which increase futility. Sometimes just talking a lot doesn't mean there's any advantage, right? There's no advantage in just saying a lot of words. Have you met somebody that can say a lot of words and say nothing? Like, you just say a lot of words, and at the end, you're like, what were they even talking about, right? I think there's a class on that to be a politician. They are artists in saying and being interviewed, and at the end of the interview, you're like, I have no idea what they just said, right? And so in this case, there's this futility. Verse 12, for who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, during the few years he has on the earth, or these few futile years, he will spend them like a shadow, for who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? This really harkens back to James chapter 4, verse 13 through 15, right? What does James say that our life is? A vapor. How many of you shower in the morning and your shower or your bathroom fills up with vapor? And you're like, would you please go away so I can shave, right? You know. So life is fleeting. It is that vapor. And James talks about very much that kind of concept, that we shouldn't make plans for, you know, I mean, it's not good to say, I'm gonna go and do this and this and this with any kind of certainty, but to say if God wills. Like if it's God's will that this happens, that I have time to do this, then this is what we'll do. But keep things in perspective. In the same way here, we need to make sure that we keep things in perspective. For the answer to this question, for who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, who knows that answer? God does. And he's winding up to that answer, right? I mean, that's at the end. He drops the hammer and drops the mic at the end of this book. But who knows what's good for man but God? And if I live my life in respect to that, like going to him to find what's good for my life, then things go well. And we've already talked about that, that if I recognize that my thing, my blessings are from God, and I use those to bless and honor, to honor him and those around me, things are going great. But if I use them just to hoard them up and never spend them, and hoard them up and never have anybody after me to take them, then things go sideways and I'm not happy. We are designed in a certain way to God says, I will bless you, but you better be a blessing. And when we can be a blessing, then there's happiness found in that. But if I'm just hoarding them up for myself, that I build bigger barns, thou fool, right, is what Jesus said in the parable about that type of individual. But God knows what is good for us. But we don't know what happens after us. We can have all these grand plans about what's going to happen after we die. But in the end, do we have any control over that? We have no control, right? We just live good enough so that we hopefully don't put us in a coffee can and bury us somewhere, right? That's, or like a donkey. But we wouldn't know, right? We wouldn't know. Even if they treated us like a donkey, we have no idea. So probably wouldn't care either. So who cares at that point? So if we keep moving along, the value of seriousness, you know, some people are, you know, too serious, demasiado serious, but in this case, there is a time to be serious, and of course, Solomon writes about a time and a season for things, and talking about the value of, and talks about wisdom and folly are kind of talked back and forth. Is a good name important? Is it? If I were to say the name Kavanaugh, is a good name important? Yes, it is. Very much so. I mean, we know kind of what happened. That boy needed some ointment after everything he went through. But it says here, a good name is better than a good ointment or fragrant oil. You probably know this. They didn't have Axe body spray back then, right? I probably didn't have to tell you that. It's not been around that long. But thankfully. But in this case, in a lot of ways, they would have a fragrant oil. Whenever they'd have parties or something, get-togethers, they would hand out a fragrant oil because it gets people stink, right? I mean, you know. So they would hand out this fragrant oil, and so it would make everything just a little bit nicer, right? Just a little bit more nice. And so that's what's saying, a good name is better than a fragrant oil. You would want somebody to enjoy your presence, right? That's why we bathe, right? So you would want somebody to enjoy your presence. You don't want somebody to not enjoy your presence. Proverbs chapter 22. No surprise that this was written about in other places. Proverbs chapter 22. Verses 1 and 2 talk specifically about this kind of concept. A good name is to be more desired than great wealth. Favor is better than silver and gold. The rich and poor have common bond. The Lord is their maker of them all. A good name is to be more desired than wealth. Why would we think that? What advantages can you see as far as a good name? What's that? Trust. If you are a trustworthy person, then you will gain favor in that way, so people will trust you. What are some other things that it's good to have a good name? Respect, a legacy, right? You may not want to be a child of certain individuals, right? There's some people in the Bible I don't know that I'd want to be a child of. I might want to be a child of Josiah or a child of David, but, you know, there's some, I don't know if I want to be the child of, like, Ahab or Jezebel. You know, those are some names I might not want to be children of. So a good name, as far as that's concerned. What about, did you know that even as an elder in the church, you're supposed to have a good name? Elders in church are supposed to have a good name to those who are without, have a good reputation. So that's kind of what that, you know, it talks about. So a good name is better than a good ointment or fragrant oil, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. Well, I don't know if I agree with that one. What do you think? Is the day of one's death better than the day of one's birth? Yeah, it depends on a lot of things. Some of you are shaking your head. Some of you are like, I don't know where you're going with that. But if we put this in biblical perspective, how does that work? Yes, blessed are the dead that die in the Lord, right? And so there's that kind of concept. And, you know, if you had to start all over again, you have to go through junior high again. I mean, who wants to do that, okay? So, you know, sometimes it's better just to be dead. Did anybody ever say that? who said, it would be better for me, it would be a whole lot cooler if I was dead. But yeah, so Paul, when he was writing to the Philippian church, Philippians chapter 1, verses 21 through 24, what was he saying there? What was he trying to communicate to the church there? Philippians chapter 1, 21 through 24. It's open book. What was he trying to communicate to them? It would be awesome. I could just check out of this. I have been stoned like 3 times and it wasn't herbal, right? So I would like to leave, right? I would like to leave. But it's better for me to be, it's better for you that I'm here. What kind of life is that? That's a servant sacrificial life, right? Where did Paul learn that? Where do you think he learned that? Did he learn it from Gamaliel? Maybe he learned it on the road to Damascus. He might have learned it from Christ, right? When Christ's example was exactly that, right? And he even says that in chapter 2 to the Philippians, to have this mind in you. Yes, sir? Yes. Oh, he had been forgiven a lot. And I wonder sometimes how much he struggled with that when he in his alone time, you know. But yes, he had been forgiven a lot. And Christ mentions that specifically as far as to those who have been forgiven much, love much. And here we see that is what we're living towards is death, right? We're born to live towards a good death. And that's the writer here puts that in perspective. This phrase in chapter 2, or verse 2, it's better, is repeated quite a bit in wisdom literature. If you want to write out there, Proverbs chapter 21, 9 and 19. Proverbs chapter 21, 9 and 19. Read those in your spare time. Husbands, you might want to check that out. But it's better, right? It's better. It's better. Some of you are already reading them. Okay. But it gets used quite a bit, that phrase. And I think it's also very important to kind of key in on that. If somebody says, you know what, it's better if you do this, you might want to listen, right? And so it's better to go to the house of mourning than go to the house of feasting. But I don't know if I want to listen to that. What is he talking about? And we see a lot of that right now in verses 2 through 4. It's better to go to the house of mourning than go to the house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. What is he trying to get at? Why is it good to go to funerals, according to Solomon? Oh, that's exactly it. That's exactly what he says. We're heading that way so we get some perspective, because that's the end of every man, and the living takes it into heart. How many of you have thought about your life when you're sitting or standing before a casket? How many of you have been here even for a funeral and thought about what's mine going to be like? How many people are going to show up to mine? When is mine? So we think about those things. Right? In how many of you do that with weddings? When we see big, important things, and you see like couples holding hands and getting all sappy at weddings, you know? So those kind of big events do what? They make us think about our own. And he's telling you there's wisdom in going to a funeral. So if someday you have an opportunity, I can go to this party with my friends, or I can go to a funeral. Solomon says, go to the funeral every time. It puts things in perspective. It keeps us understanding of what's really going on. Psalm chapter 90, Psalm 90 verse 12, David says, teach us to number our days. Teach us to number our days. Have you ever seen somebody or talked to somebody that just felt like they're talking like they're never going to die? Especially the youth in their vigor. They talk about and they make plans like as if they're never going to die, right? Solomon, who was a man of warfare, or not Solomon, David, who was a man of warfare, man of battle, who probably saw his life flash before his eyes on several occasions, said, help us to number our days. Know that it's not going to be forever. There's wisdom in that. And so the living takes that to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. The mind of the wise is in the house of the mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. And the contrast he's talking about, in verse 2 when he says to go to the house of feasting, he's talking about reckless revelry. Just go enjoy life, just have a good time, sow your wild oats kind of thing. He said that is not where you're going to, are you going to really find reality in those kind of scenarios? Because typically what you're going to do when you go to those things, you're going there to forget that life has some bad things in it. You're going there to forget about what's going on, that I will die someday, right? And maybe imbibe in things that help us to forget those. So that's what typically happens at those kind of things. And so he's saying it's better. The mind of the wise is in the house of the mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. Death is a silent rebuke to the wise. Death is a silent rebuke to the wise. If you heed death's warning, I will die one day. What am I doing between now and that moment to make it worth it? And so Solomon brings that to our minds in this section of Scripture. Any thoughts, comments before we close tonight? Sorry to end on a somber tone, but that's Ecclesiastes. Y'all have a great week. Thank you for your time.